Have we any drinks? Yes. Right. Haven't Beth got some stimulating questions? Well, we'll start off with a little idea which sprang up in discussion a few days ago about reading to get some benefit out of what is being read. It's related also to the problem of choice. And you remember that when we were considering choice, we made a triangle and then on the base we put A and not A, and then at the top we have some determinant concept to which we refer when we have to decide whether something is A or not A. When we come to read, we should read either for amusement or for information, or to determine our attitude and action to life in some way. And in order to do so, we must have a governing concept, so that when we're reading the book, we can continuously bring this concept into the field of the book and examine the ideas presented by the author in the light of the governing concept. You know, some books have a preface, and in German, some of them have a Nachwort, and says at the end what it's supposed to be about. If the preface or the Nachwort is relevant to the book, it should help you. And it should help you by saying something about the subject matter of the book, by illuminating its governing concept, out of which the book springs. A book really is an idea developed over a series of chapters or a number of words or a juxtaposition of letters. We're dealing with the alphabet, and the alphabet arranged in various ways conveys all the ideas that human beings who use language to think with do in fact manipulate. Suppose when we take our concept of the human being and the HMN, I put the H in the middle to represent the chest, the M below for the substance, and the N above for the know-how. N for know-how. That's the nous, or nous. When we come to examine anything whatever presented to us in a book, if we have this governing concept, we can test the validity of the book in terms of a threefold idea. This H represents the power of the source precipitated into the individual, and that same power condenses and by circulation encloses the zone, which it then fills up with its own motions, and when it has filled itself up to the limit, we say it has reached optimum power saturation, which is the same thing as optimum substantialization. M means substance. H means power. It is that power which, by rotating and then closing and contracting itself, produces substance. Substance is power, locked up and thrown down, that's the sub in substantia, and therefore we can say there is no substance other than power so precipitated. When the power then has precipitated a sphere of itself by itself, and by compacting itself has made a substance, then further activities of the power upon this substance change the form of the substance, introduce new determinants, And these new determinants, these formal changes, are represented by N. The N negates the uniformity of the substance, and in so doing introduces differentiating factors into it. Now that nous is form, and the word for form in the Greek is idea. An idea in the head is simply a form in the mind. But there are no forms in the mind other than forms produced by power, self-precipitated into substance, and then acted upon by further power to produce modifications. You know the rule that we make: no being can know other than the modifications of its own substance. When that power precipitates itself as substance, then whatever happens in that place will be the object of consciousness in that zone. The idea or form perceived in that substance is simply the product of the activity of the power within that substance. Now the power field itself is felt as feeling. The substance itself is felt as a will to be, an urge to exist. The coherence of substance, gravity, the tendency for substances to integrate, to mass, to coalesce, is all symbolized in this letter M. Idea, feeling, and we can call it, if we like, the urge to be, down here. These three we can consider to be manifestations of the Absolute. Now they are not, in fact, severable. You cannot cut them and put them away from each other totally. To believe so is abstract thinking. You cannot take an idea and cut it out of the substance of your being so that the idea is insubstantial and still retain the idea. The idea is the form of a substantial modification produced by power which has itself become that substance. So when you are reading a book, I hope it's a serious book, about anything whatever, you should ask yourself, what is the substance of this book? What is the power of this book? And what is the form of the book? The Latin forma is the Greek translation, the translation of the Greek idea, and in Saxon of course it is shape. Shape, form, idea mean the same thing. Circumscription, characterized, or characteristic, limitation. It's idea, form, shape. Now, the substance of a book is the urge to be, which manifested in the author and caused him to bring that book to be. The substance in our bodies, which we get by intake of food, is also precipitated by the urge to be. People who lose the urge to be lose their appetite. And as the appetite diminishes, then the substance diminishes. So there's an equation between the urge to be and the appetite of a person. Now we can be on different levels. This urge to be, which is substantial, once it has brought itself into simple being, like a uniform substance, the ivory of a billiard ball, is not satisfied with being in that state. It wants to do something else. And not only that, there are forces outside that also want to do something with that ivory. They attack it. Whatever the substance is, it has an enemy, namely power outside it. That power may invade it in the form of cosmic radiations or bacteria. It may invade it in many ways. But as soon as a being comes into finite existence, that being is under attack from forces which themselves have not got the urge to be in precisely that form. We then look in the book we read for the urge to be which made that book precisely that book and not another, we see just how much the author has felt in himself the meaning of this urge, has become aware of the characteristics of the field which have produced this being rather than another. And we examine the ideas, the forms, shapes, which the power has induced in the substance in order to clarify itself. When we take the first power, the field, and we deliberately remove MN from it, the man, the evaluator, then we take field consciousness as such, with no determinant factors in it at all. Now, as soon as we remove the MN, that is the motion of the substance, or substantial motion, we have removed the mensuration concept, and therefore we have a pure field, unmeasurable, undefinable, infinite. But that field is not nothing as a mere negation, because that field is a field of feeling. We are in this room, the walls circumference. The walls are made of substance and have a certain form, with the approximate right angles at the corners and so on. This confines our attention. With our attention is a tension within a field. We feel immediately that the walls are not infinitely thick, but they are only finitely thick, and beyond it there is space. There is the park, there is Liverpool, there is the world, the solar system. This field extends infinitely, and we have immediate awareness, not reasoned awareness, immediate awareness of this infinite extension of the field. This field then, in its pure form, without N or M, is an abstract idea. You cannot in fact sever the field, because if you say I am an individual, man, MN, and I will now proceed to abstract H, the field, in fact, you are deliberately ignoring the abstractor himself, the MN. And therefore you're really pretending that you're doing something which you're not doing. The man, the evaluator, is pretending that there is a field with no man in it. But it is a man who is pretending. And therefore he's really abstracting. He is taking out from the consciousness something, MN, and throwing it away. And pretending it doesn't exist. Factually it does. Now in every kind of concrete thought, the concrete objective fact for pure consciousness contains MHM, the great Mahan. Or it contains the MHM, the Mahan, lovely Yiddish name, very wealthy family. Or the divine human. Now if we remember that these three are always present and are not severable, then we can understand certain metaphysical facts. We can consider the world's religions in their proper form. The field, which is undefined, undefinable, when considered abstractly, is factually the power which substantially occupies space and formally moves in space. All the negating factors or limiting factors represented by N, which represents this actual boundary which negates the infinite and thus posits the finite, all those things are within the field. The packing of power within the negative zone substantializes it, and again this is within the field. In the Gospel of John it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. But in the English one they have left out a slight difference which occurred in the Greek, where the words the God and a God are used. Although there's no definite article in the Greek, the statement is used with the definite article, the God, and without it, God, which is translated really a God. So there is the God and a God. Now this field, absolute, is the God. But the largest finiting, the largest sphere, than which we can conceive no larger, is a God. And that God is the God of worshippers within it. When we say in him we live, move, and have our being, we can mean either in the macrocosmic body of God, the Christ body, the Logos body, or we can mean the infinite field. When Christ says that no man has seen the Father, he is referring to this field, which being infinite, being undefinable, is absolutely and forever unseeable in any sense of the word finite. And nevertheless, that field is the power which is doing the seeing of this cosmic logos. Now all body, by the meaning of the letter B, is circumscribed. You pronounce B by closing your mouth, packing energy behind it, substantially air, and thus filling the mouth and then exploding it. You really pile up M, you hum, and then you press hard and release it suddenly, and B occurs. This B, which is the English word booth, and the Hebrew beth, a house, means a closure with a compact energy in it. To be is therefore to be circumscribed. And every circumscription, no matter how big, is within the infinite. The infinite is undeterminable, undefinable, because to define is to set a limit. The fin in define is the end or limiting factor. If we think that any form, no matter how marvelous, is the end in the sense of final goal beyond which there is nothing, if we think that that goal is the purpose of man, we are already worshipping what is called in the Bible the beast. That is to say, a finite structure, no matter how clever, no matter how kind and considerate to widows and things, we are considering a welfare state. And the word state is from that root star, static and so on, to stand. And insofar as the thing is circumscribed, there are infinite possibilities beyond it. Now, the realm of the circumscribed is the realm of the moral. The M, the substantial, and the ruling principle, the ruling activity, and the ligature, the L, within it, which ties it together. So that morality is related to substantial existence and the ruling activities required to keep that system in being. This is why Christ left no moral doctrine, a thing that has been complained of many times by unspiritual thinkers, people who state-established religious people who think that the state of things on earth, a welfare state, or something else of a finite order, perfectly run, is the purpose of spirit. They are moral people, and they require you to behave in that manner which will establish and preserve this finite system. So if you came to consider all the literature on moral philosophy, if the books are any good and not written by a certain gentleman, who writes for a very cheap publisher and compiles his works and digested from encyclopedias, if they are not written by him, there will be, he's written about 40 books on different subjects, particular subjects. If they are not written by him, they will be about a substantial situation and the necessary behavior that people must conform to in order to keep it in being. And it is such a substantial situation with all the behavior patterns necessary to keep it in being, which is referred to in the Bible as the beast. Because, in effect, it is like a beast. You see, the beast is represented as head orientated to the ground, to where its food is, to matter. So that the beast mentality is directed down into this material system. The beast lacks comfort. The beast does not create unique new things. and so on. The beast is in the groove, it repeats over and over again. And no matter what kind of beast it is, it hasn't got inside itself the power to change itself and become other than it is. If a mutation occurs at the level of beast, it can only occur because an alien force, a cosmic radiation or a chemical force, acts on the genetic factors in it and forces a change, the change being forced from outside. And this is why the animals are not human. The essential thing about the human being is that he can, without waiting for a cosmic force, without waiting for a given chemical, can find inside himself an awareness, the field awareness, which being refined makes him aware of the cosmic ideas, and which makes him aware of the urge to be in things, and he then has the power at the feeling level of preferring one thing to another from the absolute end, instead of from the end of material stimulation. So a human being differs from an animal in this, not in degree, like the evolutionists pretend. It isn't the difference in degree between an ape and a man. The difference is absolute, because the authority of man comes from inside man and has power to battle against invading forces. But the animal hasn't. The animal is determined by the nature of the stimulus and the nature of the matter involved in its being. This is a determinant difference that must always be remembered. We mustn't allow that man is simply a mineral, become a vegetable, become an animal, just slightly improved. He comes from the opposite end, from the end of pure consciousness, pure field awareness. When we then read the book, we have this governing concept. We say to ourselves, we're going to look at the book in every way possible to us and use as a guide this threefold scheme. We know what we say, cui bono, to whom the good, when something is being said, who is getting the benefit of this thing. We say it, and then we say, what is the particular urge to be manifested in this book? What is the author trying to bring into being? What is the level of his feeling awareness that makes him try to bring that into being? And what is the particular idea structure which he uses to try to justify bringing it into being? Now you then have a threefold yardstick. And the letter Y, although it sometimes sounds like an I in English words, is pronounced with a slight attack on it in the Hebrew. So instead of saying Israel, as we would say, they would say Yisrael. They attack it. Yeah. And this little attack means affirmation. So yeah, yes, yeah, and so on. We all come out to this family attack, yeah. Now if you look at the mystical diagram of this threefold path, you will find three letters, and they're in the Hebrew the yods. Those yod letters are really drawings primarily of the hand of God, like this. Cut that hand off of the wrist, and that is the form of that letter. And the word yod in Hebrew means hand, and the hand is the symbol of this power to create, to be in the hand of God. Now there are three of these pressing onto a common center here to make this letter Y. And because they are points, jots, dots, yotters, they are points of source energies for the threefold structure of man. So there are three yods here. There's the affirmation, the executive power that makes ideas, the affirmation of the field energy, and the affirmation of substance. These three must be kept quite distinct when you're reading a book. You know, the Trinity in Christianity is a difficult concept until you get to the level of concrete thinking. You must not divide the substance, you must not confound the persons. There is the Father, the Son, and the Egressive Spirit, or Holy Ghost. The Father is not the Son is not the Father, and the ghost is neither of them. But this ghost proceeds equally from the Father and the Son. Now, although they are different, they are not absolutely other. They are functionally different, and they are different persons. And it's very important to get this concept of the personal difference right. Inside the human being, you will find an awareness of an idea. This awareness of the idea is actually busy making ideas. And this is a fact. There's something in you that actually is orientated to make ideas. And this you could call the idea person. The person, the persona, is through sounding. Persona, through sounding. There is something sounding through one of these centers, which is determined to make idea. There's something sounding to another that isn't concerned with the idea, but it's concerned with the feeling accompanying the idea, which is really the field state, the vibrational field state, which results when an idea is produced, and which itself is cause of the idea produced. So we have inside ourselves this person, this through-sounding energy, which makes ideas. And we have also, simultaneously, but quite other, but not severed from, this person, this through-sounding energy, that feels the value of the ideas so made. And we also have this person, which appears as the urge to be. So we have, factually, a threefold experience in ourselves. We have an urge to be, regardless of what we're going to be. We urge to be before we know what we're going to be. We urge to be before we find out whether anybody wants to be. And before we have a clear idea of what's worthwhile being. And before we've discovered anything about sensitivity of feeling, to see whether it's worthwhile bothering to be, there is the urge to be. This urge to be, which manifests as JT and MT in the individual, this urge to be is simply an urge to be. It is a definite amount of energy from infinity appearing finitely and producing individuated substances. It is only concerned to produce substances. The urge to be, extending the urge to become, the urge to precipitate oneself into the future, the ground of the procreation urge, is not concerned with the quality of what is produced, the appropriateness to the time of what is produced, whether there's any room for what is produced. It is simply being, urging itself into expression, urging itself into existence, the urge to be, regardless of whether the thing that's going to be is rubbishy or not. A cabbage, with its resident urge to be, if it were not controlled, would overgrow the earth, and so would an elephant, and so would every other form of life, unless they were mutually restricted by these contradictory urges to be in all the finite forms. And then any single life would extend throughout the whole of infinite space and bore itself still with its essential identity. So this urge to be is factually a separate thing from this power that manifests as idea. The man who is stressed in the idea level and his urge to be is not very strong. He might languish, he might faint in a chair, and nevertheless, while he's fainting, he's having exquisite ideas, beautiful ideas like an arabesque. And all the energies in him, and the ideas are a different frequency from the urge to be, all those energies might come in and be terribly powerful and fill his mind with intellectual propositions, and he may thoroughly enjoy himself at the idea level and have no urge to be whatever, no urge to push himself into the M level to substantiate himself, because that person is only concerned with the ideas, and he may have no feeling. It isn't a question of liking or disliking at the pleasure pain level. It is a question of the energy that formulates. In the same way, another being may be stressed at the level of the feeling person. The energy sounding through the personal feeling energy will just like and dislike whatever is presented. It has no urge to be in it, and it has no idea in it. It's simply liking and disliking. It's a flux in which it presses itself a little and then stops in case it hurts itself. Then it expands itself a little and then stops in case it hurts itself. And so it's pulsing all the time, saying, I think I like it, it's a bit too hard, I'll go back. I think it's a bit too far, I'll go back. And this pulsating, feeling life is then a separate being in its own life. Now these three cannot be seven, we can't take a knife and cut them, and yet they are totally different. And this is a fact inside every human being. You have an idea, you can look at the idea, and simultaneously you can feel that you don't like the idea. And in the idea department you will hear a voice say, but this is eminently reasonable, and no doubt fits the situation and should be the formal control for all activities. And the feeling says, I don't like it. And the urge to be says, I'm busy at the moment round the corner to the widow who's got an off license. Now, these three things happen, and the men who write books, most of whom don't know that these three things operate, are busy trying to bring into being certain things. And there's a certain amount of feeling there, and a certain number of ideas. The ideas are rationally supposed to justify this urge to be, which makes them write the book. There's a book called The Hidden Teaching Beyond the Hidden Teaching. Now, that kind of book comes from an urge to be in a man. There's really no idea correspondent to it. But he has an urge to be a writer. So he writes another book, because he wants to make books. He hasn't got an idea because he wrote the final book rather prematurely last week. But the urge to be is still there, so he writes another. The final teaching beyond the ultimate. Now it doesn't matter how silly the title is, there will be buyers. Because the urge to be will want to read the book about the beyond the ultimate, because it's naturally an energy that throws itself out perpetually into infinity, and it can do so because it's drawing its energy from infinity. So it's like a little doorway. You see this bottom yod, it brings from infinity energies, spins them around and throws them back again, and on the outgoing it writes its name. On the ingoing, there is nothing there. This urge to be then can make an author produce a book, and another book, and the book to end books, and then the book to explain the book to end books, and so on. Infinitely. Simply because it's a product of the urge to be. Now the rational structure very quickly exhausts itself in dialectical principles. That is to say, the simple logic of either or. And the fact of the identity of opposites very quickly circumscribes the possible books that may be written in subject matter. But it does not in any way affect the urge to be. So when the final book has been adequately written, which is no doubt in German, then somebody will rewrite it in English. And then a German will get hold of it and translate it again, and it will come out differently. I've got a copy of a book which was written in English from notes made by Jeremy Bentham, and it was so obscure that a Frenchman translated it into French. And when the publisher wanted to do it in English, he didn't get the original, he got the French translation because it was so clear, and then did it back into English. And it's a much better book. But this is the urge to be that publishers have, the urge to be booky, to keep pushing them out. We then have a threefold yardstick to test anything whatever that we're reading. We can test, of course, what people are saying as well, because books are only sayings recorded. All the time we're dealing with a being which has these three persons inside. There is a concrete whole. And because of the law of the inequality of finites, every author must be finitely stressed differently from others. That means the mere fact that he has made a book means that he is presenting you with a stressed account of some aspect of the universe for some purpose. Probably the best books in the world are really compensation books to offset the other best books, because the best books are very powerful, they move people, and the people who can be moved by the best books are invariably moved too far, and therefore they need another best book of the opposite order to push them back again. If we remember this simple threefold principle, then whatever we are reading, we will find out very quickly whether it is sensible. Publishers on their paper jackets today give you a blurb that says something about the author and something about the book. If you read it, it may tell you what the book is supposed to be, what urge is brought into being. It is fulfilling a long felt want, and the form of the want has precipitated the book. But at the back of it all is the urge to be, pushing people to find something that people want because of the urge to be. These three cannot be separated, severed, and made into disconnected entities. So if anybody accuses you of believing in ideas only, and you want to justify yourself, balance yourself, you must say that no idea can exist which is not in a field which is feeling the characteristic action of that idea and is itself equipped with an urge to be. We were discussing last night certain aspects of acting and the necessity for analysis of a play, because a particular play, through inadequate analysis of the first act, had gone badly. The unity had been destroyed, because the first act was considered to be humorous and the second and third manifestly were not. And the trouble arose because the first act was very strongly charged with dialect. And the dialect had a peculiar kind of humour in itself, but underlying it, the subject matter was quite serious. And we then discussed the necessity, or otherwise, of analysing a play structure right through. And immediately there was a reaction that would breed intellectualism. Now, if we remove the analysis completely, you don't bother to read the play before you put it on. And when this was pointed out, it was seen that there could be a happy medium. When presenting a play, it's not a bad idea to read it first. And each person in it should read his own part and think a little about the relations, but all this is intellectual activity. If, when the analysis is done, then the person refers only to ideas and nothing else, then the acting performance will be deficient in the urge to be. There will be no drive behind it. Also, he will not feel adequately the relation between the idea forms and the audience reactions. The danger of intellectualism is abstraction. That is, taking the idea and pretending you can have an idea valid in and of itself, which is not substantially the product of an urge to be, and is not itself felt. I don't know if any of you saw the little short program on the Stanislavski method stuff on the program recently, where an analysis was made, a triangle analysis of an actor, another actor, and an audience. It was said that a certain kind of actor never lets his mind go outside himself. He doesn't know there's an audience, and he doesn't know that there's another actor. This is the kind that we would actually call a narcissus. He is reflecting on himself. It's sufficient for him actually to be on the stage and to act. If you think there aren't any such, then you're mistaken. There are. One I know who actually says he doesn't care if nobody comes, and he doesn't care if there's no audience and if the other actors all get the flu and don't turn up. He can go on and do his part, and he wants no more. And he's quite serious about this, because he feels that he's sufficient in his own emotions and interpretations to satisfy himself. And that was called actor number one. Then there was another actor who was aware that there was an audience, but he was totally unaware that there was another actor. So he played to the audience, he tried to amuse the audience, to frighten the audience, to move the audience, but he didn't know there was another actor. That was the second time. Then there was a third time that knew there was another actor. And here the analysis really was incomplete, because they only had the three types. This kind knew there was another actor, and they concentrated on the play, and luckily he got another actor the same order. And between them they created a tension in their interrelations such that the audience were forced to take notice of. And when the Stanislavski expert represented this diagram, immediately one of the students said, "Are we supposed to forget that the audience exists completely?" Because he felt that it was incomplete. We'd had a narcissistic actor, and we'd had one that was aware of the audience, but not another actor, and then a third actor who was aware that there was another actor. But in fact, every actor who is top level and knows his job is aware of the other actor, and he is aware of the audience's reaction to himself and to the other actor and to the significance of the play simultaneously. And the man who can do this has what is called good time. He doesn't lose a lot. If his brother actor on the stage gets a slight snigger from the audience, lasting 5 seconds, he doesn't come in with his line on the 3rd second and lose it. He just holds it sufficiently. He might even say the first 2 words, but he'll repeat them again at the very moment the laugh is dying and bring it up again. So really, there is another order of actor. The one who is aware of the whole situation, who knows there's an audience, who knows there are other actors, and who knows that there is a play of significance. Now this is a fuller analysis than the one that came. You can see immediately, if we take the actors as individual human beings, there are individual human beings, even actors are individuals. An individual may be a narcissist. He may be so saturated with himself that he can go into his own single room flat, stand before a full length mirror and admire himself till bedtime. This actually happens. Another individual can be aware of his effect on a group of people and at the same time be totally indifferent to his relation with any other individual within that field. That's second. Another one may be aware that there is another individual and relate to that individual and totally forget that there is an audience. Sometimes children pick up strange words because two such adults have forgotten that they're not alone and they talk at their own level and they don't know there's an audience. But if you're really aware that there is an audience, obviously, as consciousness is a catalyst, it must modify your conversation. And if you see here a frown and there a smile and there a look of indifference in a large number of people, it must, if you're aware of it, modify somewhat the demands made on the situation. But still, that's only the actors and the audience relation. At the back of all of it is the play and its significance. When Shakespeare said all the world's a stage, he meant what he said. It is a stage. A stage is when you stand on the earth for a period. The absolute comes down, there are degrees, stands on the earth, a stargate, stage, and then goes back again. It is a stage in the development, the de-veiling or removing of the veils from the optics by meditation upon the source spirit from which we derive. Now all the men and women on this earth are at a stage of development requiring external stimulation from the world of matter and from each other. And in that process of mutual stimulation, they are made aware of higher degrees of being. If we then know the purpose, it is like knowing the plot of the play, knowing the significance of the plot. And we then keep this ground significance, and we use this significance to make our threefold analysis. So if we now look back at this HMN, this human being, and we see that the field absolute has precipitated substances, I say substances plural, because each zone of compaction is a unific substance, it has produced substances, and then between these substances, relations. And the form of activity of the substances, which is the N, conditions the substantial state of other beings. All is produced by this field, which is felt. And this feeling state prior to the precipitation of substances is the pure light of the absolute. It's the clear light in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. It's called the clear light in lots of Buddhist works. It's called the clear light because it has no shadow of turning in it. Now, no shadow of turning means there are no rotations. This field absolutely is light because light is a propagation, a motion of this power. And when it is not considered to be rotating, turning, there is no shadow in it. There is no shadow of turning. It is the clear light. There is no shadow of turning. It is the clear light. When it is experienced, which it is in post-mortem states and it is in certain meditations, the difficulty arises of losing it because it is undefined. It is a pure ocean of equable light, the light that never was on land or sea. But that light is itself permeating every form, every finite, so that all finites are transparent to it, and therefore they are as if lost in that ocean of light, so that all the individual men call value is transcended in that light. And therefore, although people reach it in their post-mortem state, they usually fall either to M or to N very shortly afterwards. If they have the urge to be dominant, they fall back into incarnation at the material level, or strive to do so. If they have the urge to understand the form of their experience, then they move into the subtle world of ideas. Now, it's obvious that the urge to be is the cause of incarnation, and the urge to understand is the cause of the movement in the opposite direction. You have field energy, and the field energy may appear as substance, and it may appear as form. But if it appears as substance only, it produces a unified mass inertia. If it appears as form or idea, then understanding of the relations, fundamentally mechanical, of the forms appears in the mind, and then the inertia, mass inertia, is overcome. And this is the twofold tendency of the field energy, to precipitate the mass, which then becomes inertia and repeats itself, and to precipitate the form. And the form tends to break the inertia, but the inertia, if dominant, tends to stop formal development. Now, the male mind tends to break into the idea world, and the female mind into the substantial world. And so, we would find in the medieval scholastics a statement that the soul of the woman is moving in this direction and is not of a rational bias. And remember, rationality is only formal presentation. And if abstracted from the field and urge to be, becomes in effect a pseudo entity. It has no reality if you deprive it of its substance and of its feeling experience. And yet, in itself, it gives you the rational, that is, the proportional, formal relation of the things that have got the urge to be and do exist in the field. return to the books for a moment. When we read a book, let's look at it, try to find out what was the urge to be which precipitated the substance of this book. We can do this by examining the ideas in the book, what he claims to be doing, and we test the idea structures for consistency to see whether the thing he states is actually carried out. The Indian method of doing this in literary criticism is to read the beginning of the book, a preface to this one, then the end of the book, and to write what it said at the beginning and what it said at the end down, and then to draw a line, and then to read the book very carefully. And all the things that are relevant, you write on this line. All the things that are irrelevant to it, and that are really higher ideas, you write up here. And all the things that are irrelevant and lower ideas, you write below this line. Now, if you do that with any book, you will find that most of them stick out with sore thumbs all over. They have been made by men in general who have been biased, either on idea, the philosophers, the Pi men, all the Greek philosophers who begin with a P, like Plato and Pythagoras and Proclus and so on, all those men are concerned with a formal analysis. They tend to devalue the urge to be, and we could say that they are Apollonian, they are order men. They like to rationalize the state and say how it should be run. Plato's Republic is typical. The urge to be men are Dionysian. They are going to break every form produced by the rationalists, because they want to carry on being and becoming. So there will be a conflict between books written from M and books written from N. And if an author is not sure of himself, and that means an author, then there will be some elements of M and some of N in him fighting. And when they fight together, they always produce a feeling of indecision in the book. So you clarify the formal content of the book and the substantial ground of the book, and you use these two ideas to test how clear the man's ideas were, how much energy he had backing those, and how much feeling awareness of the conflict between these two within his organism. Have any thoughts about that?
One of the things that's often occurred to me with regards to backwards, like that, is that there must be, to a certain extent, when a person is acting out an event, a tendency towards invocation. Is that so?
I would say nearly 100% of actors would think that you were being a little mysterious.
Well, what I was thinking about is that there must have been a certain amount of energy in a particular event. If you reenact that event completely, would that be an invocation of that event?
It would, but you would not then conform to the definition of an actor as used by an actor. If you said to an actor you are invoking the entities in the play into your being, in a magical sense, which is what you mean, you'd be terribly surprised and also terribly frightened.
You may not know that he's doing it, but what I'm asking is, could he be doing it?
And he could only do it if he were aware that you were doing that, and that was his intention.
What I'm thinking about, for instance, was that a particular actress played for a long period a highly emotional play, a part, a highly emotional part, in which he was supposed to be a semi-mental case.
Yeah.
And after she'd done this for a certain period, she actually became mental. But she had a very severe breakdown.
Yes, well, you have to distinguish there between conditioning the nervous system by sheer repetition and invoking, calling in transcendent forces. The magician is calling in forces outside himself. He's invoking spiritual energies, calling them in, and he knows they exist. Now, the actor who may play the part of an erotic is by repetition of a certain behavior pattern, conditioning the nervous system and establishing a line of least resistance. And if he does, he's what they call a very unlucky actor and has a long run of 600 performances. Then the nervous system would have been knit in such a way that it wouldn't respond in any other way from that. But that wouldn't be invocation. That would be a purely mechanical process of conditioning, like a Pavlov dog. Whereas invocation is of a totally other order. I know a few actors who actually know that it's possible, and in their own work do, when they can get away with it, practice invocation. Sometimes they don't invoke the author's intention as an individual, because the idea of trying to get to the author was bigger than the author knew about. Then they invoke the idea that he would have dealt with if he had been aware of it. When that comes through, it comes through very forcefully and very slowly. But it does tend to make the other actor look weak. So it has to be pulled down deliberately in order to avoid destroying the unity of the play. But they must be kept perfectly separate. Repetition of an act in which you believe that you are simply giving an interpretation of a character by physical behavior, using your voice, intonation, and so on. That is merely a conditioning process at the physical and psychological level. Whereas an act of invocation is taking a transcendent spirit, transcendent to the individual magician. And by a certain process of heightening the will to bring a resonance relation between the will of the individual magician and this transcendent force, in such a way that the transcendent force, which is always seeking a body, every spirit seeks a body as a rule. If the magician elevates his will to that point, then that transcendent spirit was just waiting for somebody to do that. And immediately he calls, it comes in. Then arises the problem of banishing, which is just as hard as invoking. It is actually done by a system of opposite forces, where it is done successfully.
The medieval passion players would be attempted invocation, wouldn't they?
They were not so intended, no. They were intended to teach more or less church doctrine, right, in a fairly simple form, and to make it visible and to determine the attitude of people towards certain doctrines, to condition behavior, really. You know, actually, the actors were not all professionals, few were, and they would select from the citizens people to play the parts, and they would then present one of these passion plays simply as an action determinant for people. And of course people began to enjoy them as plays, and they had to introduce little amusing bits to keep the attention of the audience. And very quickly the church leaders discovered that those presentations were not doing what they ought to do. They weren't making people aware of religious doctrine. They were merely biasing people to enjoy the play. And so the church decided to discontinue them. And when they did, then the laity took them over. And really, our theatres are an evolute of religious drama, which aimed at conditioning the activity of people. So it is not invocation at all. Where invocation occurs, it can only occur with individuals who have reached a certain level of understanding, that is, their ideas are right about it, they have a definite urge to be, to become, and they have a field awareness which makes them able to resonate, to respond with these transcendent forces. We must never be deceived by a superficial similarity between two processes which really come from opposite ends of the universe, just like the scientific concept of evolution and the real concepts behind religion. On one end you have the free, and the other end the devil. The whole man has free dome. The scientist is concerned with dome analysis. The true religious mind is concerned with the free and how to get more of it. and yet in the middle it looks as if a certain activity could be explained from either end. And then the danger is that you might explain it from above, when in fact, to the participants, it came from below.
Could you give us an example of this threefold analysis by taking the work which probably most of us have read, like Alice in Wonderland or something? I'd rather like to understand more of its practical application.
The only way to do that would be actually to get the book and be able to do it.
I see.
We did do a little the other day with one of the people here, and it took, I think, about half an hour to do the first sentence. Because we have to examine every idea. Because the idea we miss is an essential part of the development of the argument. The word always actually occurred in this sentence, and really it was not applicable in the situation described. The book was the Discourses of Epictetus, and this word always occurred, and it should not have been. It may not have been in the original, it might be a fault of the translator. Certain words you have to be terribly careful. We might actually get some copies of a book of that kind and go through it. Certain parts of the Socratic discourses. The Stoic works like Epictetus are very clear to read, and they're clearly expressed, but it doesn't follow that everything that is said is perfectly accurate. And to find this out, we have to take it and say at each level how this HMM function applies to all the terms. You mentioned Alice in Wonderland, you see. Lewis Carroll is supposed to have told these stories to amuse a little girl. Now, we know for a fact that these books are studied by mathematicians and logicians, and are possibly the most quoted books next to Shakespeare and the Bible in English. They're all over the place. Now, therefore, they must have some substance in it. Lewis Carroll's dissertations on time and so on really are quite valuable when you come to consider the problem of time, and his references to certain evolution of peoples, development and relation of nations. As represented in the Caucasus race, it makes everybody get very dry, being a reference to Caucasian people who are not emotionally sloppy. We have to take each expression and discover its meaning within its context. We have to find what Lewis Carroll was urging, or what was urging through him, trying to get into being, trying to be expressed. Then we have to evaluate the feeling behind it. The tremendous humour behind it, in no sense, is spoiled by the form of it, nor by the actual urge to power that's in it. Everything is peculiarly symbolic. He's been a tremendous study to psychologists, simply because, while he, you could say, while he thought, as some people think, while he thought he was telling a funny story for a little girl, in fact, he was busy thinking up certain relations in his mind, relations theological, political, social, anthropological, and so on. And these relations he worked out in the form of a funny story. Because there's a peculiar coherence in these books. Alice herself is the soul, which she's got to get to the eighth rank. Eight means eternity, infinity. Carroll, as a theologian, knew exactly what he meant by that, but it appeared as a funny story. So if you take a book like that, of course, you've taken a highly complex book, and it will lead you into all sorts of metaphysical and religious realms straight away.
to be urging in Jabberwocky?
Well,
a strange word.
The portmanteau words. You see, what Carroll calls portmanteau words are words that are made out of more words than one put together to convey a complex idea in apparently one word by using half of one word and half of another. We came part of the way tonight behind the lorry with the word jubbly on the back. Whole orange juice. It was made out of juicy and bubbly. Now that is a typical Carroll portmanteau word. So brillig and slimy toads and so on. Slimy was made out of slimy and lime. And the word manages to convey roughly that slimy and lime and slimy. Because the essential consonant which Carroll as a Hebrew scholar knew, he retained. He didn't cut the word indiscriminately unless lose half of it. He retained the essential parts of the word and put them together so that they really did compress those dual meanings. Carroll is a marvelous exercise in that sort of thing. Even logically, see, would you like some more? I can't have any more because I have none. You mean you can't have any less? You see, the logic behind is penetrating through mental inertia. People are conditioned by forms of expression. These forms of expression really blind them, completely blind them. You see a peculiar volte-face in the attitude in certain people towards nuclear bombs at the moment. You see sudden upspurts of ethical awareness and humanity. Why? Because they're all scared stiff. No other nation would think for a moment that suddenly all the people in England will become kind-hearted. What are all the subject peoples of the once British Empire think? It's quite simply that Britain is too small to drop heavy nuclear bombs on. And therefore they are becoming suddenly moral, ethical. Nobody's really convinced. And the few people who really are against destruction still remain a few people. People that were against destruction when they were not afraid for their own skins. But their ranks have suddenly swelled, apparently. There are millions of kind-hearted people who don't want to bomb anyone, simply because of the small size of their native country. Right. So when you're listening to a political speech, say what is the thing that the urge to be is trying to precipitate. What is the feeling behind it? Does he feel kind about it? Is he doing it because he likes something or because he hates something? There are only two feelings, liking and disliking, love and hate, in various intensity. And what is his rational form whereby he justifies trying to bring this thing to be? You might try as an exercise equating the three political parties with H, M, N. See? There's the M, which is the Labour Party, the N, which is a conservative party, and the H, which is a liberal party. You would naturally expect that in periods when feeling diminishes, the liberal party should diminish too. When the rational structures are on top, then the conservatives are controlling the situation. And when the forces from below rise up in revolt, then you know very well that the urge to be has got the upper hand for the time of any rational attempts to inhibit. And yet these three parties are parts of a whole, and therefore party politics is essentially wrong, because it pretends that one part can handle a whole situation. Factually, behind all party government in this country is the government, which never changes. It juggles by various mathematical and geometrical means, fooling about with divisions in modes of counting, propaganda, he juggles one party into being and another party out to being according to the difficulties of the problems to be faced. If the problem is fairly easy to solve, they put in their favourite party, and if it's difficult, they put in the other party, and when it fails down, then the time for that problem has fulfilled itself, the thing is going to be easier, and their favourite party is put back in. The fact is that it is party, and the part cannot govern the whole. There should be a whole government. There is, but it is juggling with parties, simply because people themselves are parts. And being stressed on their individual existences, they don't want to know about the whole. Not until the weapon becomes so powerful that they have to consider that there is a whole. A young actress the other night was profoundly shocked when she saw in a newsreel Princess Alexandra dancing with black men and brown men. Quite close. She was very upset. She said that couldn't have happened 30 years ago. Well, it couldn't. It wasn't expedient. Suddenly it's become expedient. Consciousness of the whole human race is actually now being forced by sheer terror. But that's not good enough. That's only the beginning of it. The beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. Now, unless you can equate the nuclear bomb with the Lord, you can't say that the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the nuclear bomb. Because that kind of fear is no good. Because as soon as you remove the pressure, either by eliminating the bomb, or by finding something that can disintegrate it at its place of origin, then people relax back to their previous level. Because really they haven't changed. Now this change can only come from within. It cannot come from an external stimulus. It can't come from a promise of social improvement, therefore the welfare state can't do it. The welfare state is the bridge, promising to make people comfortable if they don't upset the status quo. Anything whatever from outside that conditions people's behaviour is anti-spiritual. And spiritual decisions can only come from inside, and only then freely, in an individual, it must be an individual, who has attained sufficient reflexive self-consciousness to extricate himself from the external stimulus and its mnemic traits. If you can't rescue yourself from the external stimulus, if you can't rescue yourself from the memory of such stimuli, factually you're in bondage.
Small condition there. The fall back into the earth level, this embodies the idea of the eternal recurrence, I imagine.
Yes.
What is the possibility of the fall back into the fallen world?
The possibility, you mean for individuals?
Yes, as opposed to the idea of eternal recurrence when it falls back in the earth to be.
Well, let's say that the mass inertia here is gravitational centre. There's a fall in that direction from this equable state. Eden itself is this equable state. Paradise beyond duality is this equable state. All equilibrium, which to a scientist would be maximum entropy, a complete balancing out of all forces, is that feeling state. At ascension level. Once there has become precipitated the mass centre, the way it behaves is to try to drag everything into it. So that every force that is moving the other way is made by effort. You see, we fall without it. So we can become inertia without it. But if we want to get into that ideal world, we need effort. Thinking is difficult. So if we after the post-mortem experience of the life, find ourselves beginning to fall into a substantial state, we'll have to make special intellectual efforts to tell ourselves about the nature of the clear light. And these intellectual efforts are actually putting us into the ideal. We can't fall into it. We can only get into it by effort.
And this ideal world has a substantial aspect.
Oh yes.
But that substantial aspect is not of the same order as the purely mechanical recurrence.
Yeah. You see, if we take a fact that to an ordinary person without an electron microscope, this piece of chalk is a more or less uniform piece of black wax. There's no mystery about it. There's no form in it. It's just a uniform mass. So that's easily accepted. If I get on an electron microscope, put that under it and start looking at it, I'll see structure in it. But then I've already transcended the level in which this looks like a uniform mass, an inertial mass. There is form there. So if I want to penetrate beyond the inertial level, I must somehow enlarge it so that I can see the structure. Now, because every mass is finite, and every finite is subject to analysis, then we can break mass inertia by analysis. But the analytical effort is anti-gravity, anti-inertia. To sit down and think about that, even a simple thing like that piece of black chalk, to think about why it makes a mark, requires effort. Why does it make a mark? I drag it across the paper. Why does it make a mark? Why doesn't it just slide over the paper? Now you have to think. If you had a little bit of training, you'll say, under a microscope, the paper would be rough and have sharp bits on. The chalk is fairly soft. As you drag it along, the little particles in the paper scratch bits off and they adhere to the paper. That's a rough mechanical explanation. It requires a certain amount of effort to do it. A kid in school could be told that and absorb it with much less energy than it has taken to discover it. See, a simple thing like that might have taken hundreds of years to discover. The thing is self-evident, is it? You see, the Chinese use a 2 count to reckon up with. We use a 10 count. If you try to say 1, 2, and let the two represent the same thing that would be represented by 9 in the English system. So you'd have to write 1, 2, 0 after it. But the O would be equivalent to what would be a 10 in English. Immediately the mind goes a bit funny. Now most of the computers that have been built now, the electronic computers, are built on a 2 count, which the Chinese have used for hundreds of years. But we're not familiar with it, and so actually to grasp what it means is a bit difficult. We have to overcome the inertia and the records in the brain. And that we can only do by effort. And the thing that is apparently self-evident, that 2 and 2 are 4, isn't really self-evident. It is simply a conditioned reflex. And to break those reflexes, we have to get our energy together and say whatever is going on in my mind now is a result of previous conditioning. And if I prefer to be free, then I don't want to be conditioned by anything whatever other than my own will. So I scrub out, like Descartes did, the whole phenomenon. Then I seek for something to see if there's anything left. Descartes made a slight mistake. He came to the conclusion, I think, therefore I am. But he didn't notice that in putting down the word I, he'd already positive the thinker. So that really when he extended it into I think, this thinker was dragged out of the letter I. And the therefore was a causal concept which was fabricated by the I, but not by his I, but by a long line of individuals attacking the concept of causality. And I am, this repetition of the I, plus part of the verb to be, really was a highly complex structure imposed on him by hundreds of thinkers in a couple of thousand years. So when it came down to a basic proposition, it wasn't so. And later thinkers attacked it, actually invented dualism. So that when you really attack the content of your own being without any inertia, you will have to use all the energy you've got. When I attack the content of this organism, I sit down, I look at it, and I hit it like that. I take this part which I call my hand and beat it on the part I call my knee, and there arises a sensation. Now if I were concentrating on it, I might think that there was a noise made by my knuckles hitting my knee. The analysis isn't sufficient. Most of the noise is resonance, as you well know. If I took my foot off this dais here, the amount of noise would decrease considerably. If we remove the walls, and I don't sit on the chair and I do it again, there will be less noise. How much of the noise that I hear is really the knuckle on the knee? Remove all the resonance factors. How much noise is there in? You see? And close your eyes and put thumb against finger. Like this. Is it really thumb against finger with your eyes closed? No, it isn't. Because thumb against finger is a memory trace of a visual experience. What happens factually, if I close my eyes and go like this, is that somewhere in the field of consciousness, there's a feeling of a concentration. Nothing else. I can't say it's an opposition, because the idea of opposition is the idea of a duality made by my visual experience. So all I can truthfully say with my eyes closed is that within a field of awareness, there are points of precipitation. When I open my eyes, I see what I call the cause of it. But that is already a dualistic concept where the cause and the effect are dissimilar. But if I pursue my analysis properly, all that is power behaving. And if I want to consider that it had a beginning, I call it cause. And if an external, posterior result, I call it effect. But the effect is only the power behaving in that way. Now to make yourself break all of your concepts and come down to this fact, you must reduce yourself like the men undergoing training for space flight. In these countries, you see, impossible covered up vests and so on. You've never seen them before. But they're there. They're part of the vibrational behavior of your own substance. And out of those, concentrated, finited and defined, your phenomenal world is constructed. Which is why some thinkers don't accept that there is a world, other than a construct of consciousness. Now it's very, very hard work to hammer your brain and stop its inertias and make it do it. Richard II said, you take the soul, let it be the male, and your brain, let it be the female. And you hammer the soul power on the brain, the memory field, and you just knock the forms of the universe out of it by sheer aggression of your own power on itself as its own substance. It is worth. You don't fall into it. You do it only by gathering yourself to a center and aiming yourself.
Can that be equated with the statement that since the days of John the Baptist, the King of Heaven has been taken by force?
Oh, yes. Mm. See, because they, prior to that, this absolute influence into the substance was an act of grace. Mm. You see, but through certain stimuli, certain evolutions, certain examples, and certain factual changes in the nature of substance through the incarnation and crucifixion, it is possible for an individual there, knowing that the whole of the phenomenal action band around him is the enemy, deliberately and as an individual self to ignore it and to fight through it and rediscover that infinite field. But he has to fight. He takes the kingdom of equilibration by force, and he does it by finding all the opposites in the action band, which requires effort, and setting them over against each other. But you see, we already are biased in a definite direction, so that the line of least resistance for us as individual is always towards disintegration, deterioration. To find the opposite of any concept requires effort. When you get it, then they balance and you're released from both. That moment of balance is already the beginning of the clear light. When you balance all of them simultaneously, then you experience that perfect equilibration, the Edenic state. And that Edenic state is not created by man, it is an eternal fact. And if the man balances all his individual creative opposites, then he experiences it, because he's cancelled out himself by opposing his own tendencies and prayers. This is another thing where the scientific evolution and the true understanding of Christianity are completely opposed. According to evolutionary theory, accidentally there occurred a precipitation of matter. Accidentally that matter has become a radiance and produced vegetable world, animal world and man world. And there is an apparent improvement which has occurred accidentally. And therefore we can assume that the accident will continue in the same direction, and we'll all get better and better and better until we turn into angels. That's an idea at the back of people's minds. That these strange accidental forces are somehow accidentally improving all the time. The fallacy of progress. The 19th century myth. That people and society are improving, that violence is diminishing. Nietzsche had more sense. He saw that the bourgeois setup in the world, and he saw imperialism, and he saw that fatuous self-conceit of self-made men producing orderly systems, and he saw underneath the orderly system a downward force that would shatter that system. And so he just calmly predicted war after war and dreadful outbreaks of subterranean unconscious forces of bestiality. He could see Hitler and men like him destroying people just as they used to do, or are supposed to have done, thousands of years ago. And yet at that time people thought there will never be any naughty people, wars will always be clean. And this myth persists. We even try to make clean bombs, clean nuclear bombs. It's a concept of progress, and it's all accidental. The thing is accidentally becoming cleaner, more decent, more ethical, more spiritually minded. And it's utterly opposed to the fact that people sit on what in fact is hell, that is, impulses that are completely inhibited by false concepts of moral origin, which make people conform to a pattern which really is beastly and states a finite system pattern. And it makes them conform to it while these forces underneath, from M, the urge to B, are coming up against these ideological structures, and the tension between them is so great that at a certain point there's an emotional shake, and then some of the things shatters. All the ideologies are blown to bits. And a Chinese leader can say he doesn't care if there is a nuclear war, because he's got over 600 million people, they want to all be probably stopped. And we can start again.
Isn't he used to do this analysis, having read a book through in the ordinary way? Because this very critical analysis you're talking about, the example of half an hour for one sentence, means that the amount of literature one's going to get through is rather limited in one's lifetime. And I'm wondering if there is a more useful way one can read a great quantity, that is to acquire more form with less analysis, at least for a start.
Well, you know, you could read for the rest of your life, and if you don't read, analytically and in this way, consciously, you will never get the benefit of it. It would be more value, actually, to read one sentence in a book, dash through the book if you like, quickly as you like, to get a whole grasp of the urge to be that is manifesting there. But then go back, and don't care how long it takes. If you get one good book, take that Signatura rerum verbis. Now I know a man that's got all he ever wrote. That book I gave him about 15 years ago. He hasn't read it. But he's looked at all of them and thought, well, these are very, very good, and he's read little snips here and there. He has never worked. So that he didn't even know that on the first page, defining signature was the key to the whole thing. And if you don't know what Sig is and nature is, you don't know what Na and Tura is, you can't do it. With an etymological dictionary, a hard graft, and one good book, you can do it. You could do it on the New Testament. Get the New Testament, parallel Greek and English. You see? And look at the English and the Greek word. This is actually printed if you want. Look at it and see what they've done in the translation. They've taken a word that means so-and-so and they've put something else. Why? You get your Greek lexicon out and you look at the meaning of that word. It means a certain thing. You cannot get it. You couldn't get out of the English version that there were two gods in the prologue of John. Then these two gods are one God. Then this long.